Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. In the blue corner, US skull and bones man John Kerry. In the red corner for Russia, Vladimir Putin. So, what do US veterans think about it all? Are they anxious to finish the job in Syria, or have they had enough of fighting wars of aggression in faraway lands? And the BBC airs a documentary about respectable European business leaders helping Nazi war criminals to escape in the late 1940s and set up a Fourth Reich financial empire. Did you miss that one? Well, it aired on BBC Radio 4 as part of their document series back in 2008. And we have some clips in case you missed it. Plus, as Germany splashes out to restore the Nuremberg Stadium where Hitler held his famous rallies, we ask, what were the rallies really all about? And also, is this a good way to spend public money? Plus, Martin Summers, metaphorically anyway, at the G20 in St. Petersburg. We start this week with the destruction of REMPLOY, one of the most horrendous acts of this government, which is to take away employment from literally hundreds of disabled people. And I'm joined on the line by Kevin Hepworth, who's the lead officer on REMPLOY at Unite the Union. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to Drive Time.
First of all,
would you like to just tell us about REMPLOY, what it was set up to do, when it was set up originally, as I understand, by the Conservative government after World War II?
Yeah, REMPLOY was set up at the end of World War II in the first instance to find jobs and to help rehabilitate our, you know, Army and Navy and Air Force personnel who were coming back from the war, having defended our country but suffered losses of limbs, etc., as a result of their wartime efforts. And it's been run since then, providing full-time employment for disabled workers and also providing training facilities to help disabled workers get back into employment and get back into what's loosely called mainstream. It's done wonderful work for, as I say, best part of 70 years nearly, and unfortunately just short of its 70th anniversary, this condemned government has decided to pull the plug and close it down and throw literally 2,500 to 3,000 disabled workers on the scrap heap and pull away a lifeline for thousands more who've now not got that training capability.
But the fact of the matter is, what they're saying is that these businesses simply aren't viable, Kevin.
Well, we accept that. I mean, if you go right back to 2008, the then Labour government started to put in place a restructuring plan to help modernise REMPLOY. And they had to shut a number of factories reluctantly. But part of that plan was to then continue, because they left in place until things settled down, a very top-heavy bureaucracy. Unfortunately, once the last general election took place, this government then stopped all the movement of making them for, you know, mainly able-bodied, very well-paid middle and senior management redundant. They put a halt on it. Now, the unions estimate that in salaries alone, never mind getting into the complications of pensions and cars and phones and everything else, they could have saved over £16 million a year by carrying on with the then Labour government's plan of streamlining the top. But they put a halt on it because this government wanted to shut REMPLOY. We had a meeting in the House of Commons in Portcullis House with the Minister for Disabled, and she made it very clear. It was not purely about the money. this was a Tory party decision because they just did not believe in the concept of Remploy. So they didn't want Remploy to reduce its cost. They didn't want us to get it down to a sensible level that justified its existence. And as I say, it was purely Tory doctrine that they decided to pull the plug. And unfortunately, Clegg and his clowns have supported them.
Well, one of the fascinating things is some of these Remploy plants, including, we're told, the one in here, well, there was one in Bristol, which was actually making money, actually able to pay the rent on its quite large warehouse and pay all the wages and still turn a profit. So how on earth does it make sense? I mean, one can possibly understand a non-profit-making Remploy facility, Kevin, being closed down, but not surely if it is actually making money. I mean, how do they justify this?
Well, as I say, a lot of the sites hadn't got a cat in elf chance of making money because their overheads were so ridiculously high. They had, for instance, they had this ludicrous system where sites were charged over £1,000 a year cost for every computer terminal they had. And for every email address they had, they were charged £500. Just totally nonsense. It was just bureaucratic structures that just made it impossible for a site to make money. We put forward in 2007-8 a business plan which was partly accepted by the then Labour government, as I say, and part of that was to streamline the bureaucracy to get rid of all the overheads that they were carrying that were unnecessary. And that, as I say, never ended up taking place. I mean, it is an... We actually met yesterday with the company, the final meeting of what we call the Remploy Consortium, with all the senior lay reps who've represented workers in Remploy, because we're almost at the end. We're down to the last handful of factories that are still to be closed. One or two are still hopeful there may be a buyer in the wing, but it's an absolute shambles. And when the government say they've not done it for monetary purposes or it's to the best value, they've never answered to us why they have chosen to slash the redundancy package that the Labour government put in place, recognising the extra disadvantages disabled workers were going to have if they lost a job with Remploy closing. But they've reduced their redundancy pay by £5,000 per worker. I mean, that is just obscene. Some people volunteered to go in 2011 when there was a voluntary exercise and the company refused to let them go, saying no, they were vital for the future of the business, they needed them to help develop and take it forward. And then within 6 months, they're making them compulsory redundant, but they're making them compulsory redundant in it with over £15,000 reduction in redundancy pay in some cases. It's just an obscene way of treating people with disabilities.
It certainly is. I mean, it seems to me, Kevin, that you've got something like 2,500 of these disabled people basically being mugged by this government, because even if one of these Remploy plants wasn't making money, wasn't making a lot of money, or maybe just a little bit, the idea that it's actually going to cost the public purse, a bit like we were talking about the bedroom tax, moving people into the private sector where more housing benefit has to be paid, if those people are having to claim disability benefits are out of work, this is actually going to cost the public purse more. So there seems to be some sort of really quite pernicious viciousness about the way that Remploy is being treated. I wonder if you've seen any evidence of that.
Well, we're getting worried phone calls from members already, exactly because of this, because they were living and paying the full market rent because of the earnings from Remploy. So they haven't got a problem. Were because of the disability, they've got to sleep with breathing apparatus, or because of their problems in sleeping, the partner sleeps in another bedroom because they get disturbed all night because they're very restless. Now suddenly, of course, they found they've lost their jobs, the redundancy pay was slashed, and suddenly they're looking, oh well, they're told, well, go and sign on and you can get this and that and the other, and you can get housing benefit. Oh, by the way, you're not going to get a great deal because you've got two bedrooms and there's only a couple, so we think you only need one bedroom. So unless you can find a house and move out, we're going to slash your benefits because we're going to surcharge you for having the luxury of a second bedroom. A second bedroom that is vital to them in order to live. Otherwise, the partner's going to end up sleeping on a couch in the living room or something because they get disturbed all night long. Esther McVeigh, the new-ish, took over about 18 months ago, disabled minister, put out a statement either earlier today or yesterday saying how this government is seriously taking to task anybody who they suspect of hate crimes against disabled people. Well, this government's done the biggest hate crime on disabled workers with everything they've done. Closing Remploy, slashing benefits. Look at the mess that Ian Duncan Smith's got into over this new universal benefit where they've trialled it on the 1,000 or so easiest targets and they're now mums behind and they rant and blame civil servants for lying to him. It's time Mr. Duncan Smith accepted he's not fit for his job and moved out of the way. But the way this government have treated disabled people is just obscene. It's very much a case of, well, we'll attack the people who are most vulnerable and they're also the ones who are least likely to come and make a fuss outside our offices because of the medical conditions. If this government had listened to our business plan, we could have been working to reduce the cost. Yes, it would have made redundancies. Probably 400 of between 400 and 500 senior staff would have had to go, and it could have been streamlined. Yet this government, at the time when they were saying to Remploy disabled workers, no pay rise, or at the most, if you earn less than £20,000 a year, got the 1% pay rise. At the same time, 500 or so workers in Remploy who earned over £40,000 a year got a £3,000 bonus average. Now, that is the sort of attitude this government have got to people. They look after their own. The wealthier you are, the more likely you are to get a benefit out of this government.
Well, it sounds to me like, you know, sort of law of the jungle, basically. And obviously, the disabled people aren't able to survive in that kind of world. But just give us an idea, Kevin, of the sort of activities that were taking place in these Remploy factories before they were closed. I mean, we've just heard this week the Port Talbot staff are heartbroken over the Remploy factory closure there in Port Talbot. Remploy confirmed that no viable bids have been received for its furniture business. This is a furniture business in this case, but give us an idea of the sort of spread of the different activities, the different work that was going on in Remploy across the country.
Remploy, as you just mentioned furniture, Remploy was, still is, till it shuts its doors, the single largest provider of furniture for schools. They make the best quality desks, they make the best quality library furniture of any company in this country. And as I say, they provide furniture for over half the schools in this country and colleges. They will not be there. The private companies are running their hands with glee because they're going to put up their prices and charge the taxpayer even more because there'll be less competition out there in the market. Remploy in Scotland have a textile business, and it is almost all in Scotland now, and they were the sole supplier and manufacturer for our precious armed forces of anti-nuclear and biological warfare suits. The suits they have to put on if there's a fear of a chemical attack or a nuclear attack. They will not be manufacturing them. There is nobody in this country who will manufacture them. So we'll probably end up buying protective clothing from our armed forces from a third world country rather than manufacturing here. Doesn't make sense. Remploy also had an e-cycle business. They're one of the biggest single recyclers of computers and electronics in the country. They can provide, and fortunately, in Wales, in Porth, it looks like that business will survive in a smaller form where computers can be taken. They totally data cleanse them. so there's no worry of any information you've got on your computer getting out. Highly skilled, making sure there's not one jot of sensitive information left on your computer before you can then sell it on the second-hand market.
Well, I can just to come in there, Kevin, sorry to interrupt you, but you'll probably find that the National Security Agency and GCHQ have already got it.
Well,
you might find, but obviously there's a very, very, that sort of thing is extremely useful. Just going back to Port Talbot for a minute, a relative of one of the employees there said the employers, many of them disabled, were heartbroken at the news of the closure. He said they were handed letters giving them 1 month's notice. Apparently, a lot of them were crying. I feel really sorry for them. My son started after he left school. What else is he going to do now? And he echoes your comment that they're on the scrap heap now. Is that how employ workers feel, Kevin?
It's how most of them feel, yeah. And this is where this government is being very naughty with the figures. A lot of workers, because a lot of them are now into their early 50s, they recognise they're not going to get a job, so they're just saying forget it. So they're not signing on for employment and benefits. They're just taking their pension early and they're going to live on a reduced pension. So this government are hiding that fact and saying there are only 500 or so who are unemployed. That's because they've just give up. They feel that they've been kicked in the teeth. You say about the furniture, there was a bid in for furniture, and then it was withdrawn. And we suspect, having looked at what the thing, the bit behind them is, it's the Hawks hovering. Oh, well, we'll sit back, we'll let it shut down, and then we'll come an asset strip. Well, we'll just come in and buy the assets, and we'll not have to take on the people. But other people have put in bids for parts of Remploy, and they've been turned down as not viable or not meeting the requirements. We cannot, as the trade unions, or the workers themselves, get an explanation from this government, the DWP, or KPMG,
Kevin, we seem to have lost you there. As you mentioned, the interesting company KPMG. Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still. Sorry, caught them from it.
Okay, yeah. Just. Cause that's fascinating. I mean, we've had quite a lot of dealings with KPMG, Kevin, here, and I'd just be fascinated to know what KPMG's involvement has been, because they're under investigation, for example, by the Competition Commission for price fixing. They don't seem to be the most trustworthy organisation on the planet. One of their partners, for example, in the United States, was found to have been selling private confidential client information in exchange for Rolex watches and bags of cash. So what's KPMG's involvement been in the closure of Remploy?
Well, they was the ones who put together the document saying that Remploy was financially not viable. They then, having done that, also have been paid huge commissions, nobody's quite sure what. It's all shrouded in commercial secrecy when you try and find out. They have been paid to try and find a buyer for the...
Again, bit of a problem with the line, Kevin. Carry on.
And manage the process of anybody else who's showed an interest in any of the businesses. Now, we don't know what their remit from the government was. Nobody will tell you up front what you need to be able to do. All you get is it has to be believed to be a viable bid and value for the taxpayer. And that's all you get. So you don't know what it is. I've asked the question, and I know we've tried to get MPs to raise it, some of the Labour MPs have done. Why is it shrouded in secrecy? They say it is commercial sensitive information. This is talking about bids for businesses that they're probably talking about a few hundred thousand pounds, £1 million, relatively small beer. Yeah, you look at the West Coast Main Line tendering, with First Great Western and Virgin going head to head. The bid that they accepted as a government from First Great Western was totally in the public domain, and that was a multi-billion pound contract. So much so Branson obviously could take it away, they could pore over it, compare it to theirs and go back and say, well, you're wrong, you've made wrong assumptions when you've said their bid's better than ours, you've not looked at this, you've not... Now, companies who've been turned down in the bidding process have not been in that position because they're not told any information to judge it against. It's an absolute nonsense. You know, if somebody was prepared to take the risk and they're taking people's jobs and contracts on, and governments aren't having to pay out the redundancy pay and to then start paying people benefit, they should have given some of these businesses a far better chance and a crack at the whip. And they've just not done it, because what they're doing is KPMG are looking at it and saying, well, Tech Norwich, oh, well, if we shut the site down, knock it down, we'll sell it to one of the house building people and it's worth X million pounds just as a building site to us. Therefore, nobody could hope to compete on putting forward a business plan for a packaging business that would compete with a housing estate.
But just, I'm very concerned about KPMG being involved in all this, and I don't think they're actually going to, you know, we could really trust them. I mean, HBOS, for example, revealed that KPMG approved the bank's decision in May 2008 to put aside $370 million of provisions for the losses as its corporate lending division. In total, the actual losses reached $25 billion. KPMG got it wrong by a factor of 7,000%. Lloyds are likely to sue, and there may be possible fraud charges against KPMG for getting the figures so totally wrong.
I mean, they'll tell you as they go that, oh, well, there's different divisions of the business and different people are involved. But at the end of the day, our concern is this government wanted to close Remploy. KPMG obviously have a lot of government contracts, therefore were they really independent when they were looking at things, or did they, you know what they say, an accountant can make a set of figures read whichever way you like. If you want it to be positive, they can dress it up, and if you want it negative, they dress it up.
Well, it's,
so were KPMG under pressure to make sure they didn't put future government contracts at bid by coming down very heavily against Remploy having a future and not being optimistic?
I think you're absolutely right to point to the secrecy that's been involved in whether or not bids are being accepted, Kevin, as flagging up really that this is an ideological attack on Remploy rather than the excuses which are being used, which are supposedly financial. So, I mean, what do you think ultimately is the ideology, the thinking behind this? Is it simply that some companies lobbying the government feel that Remploy was unfair competition, or is there more a sort of political and ideological reason why the government doesn't like disabled people actually working and making a success of their lives?
Remploy disabled workers, almost from within a short period of time of the business starting, has always been a well-organised, well-structured trade union organisation. There have always been strong trade unions in Remploy because the trade unions from the very early days recognised the nature of the workers going into Remploy and how they needed that strong support. And therefore they've been well organised, they've been well supported, and Remploy workers have always been prepared to tell the government, whether it was this shower we've got now or the previous Labour government or the Thatcher government or the Wilson government or any other government, when they were not happy, they've been prepared to voice it. And the Conservatives especially in the 70s and 80s wanted to close Remploy then, and they didn't have a strong enough control in Parliament and a big enough will. This lot got control and they're just determined to finally achieve what they've always wanted. They just want to, just as Thatcher wanted to smash the miners and the print workers, more because you could see they were strong, organised organisations, this government wanted to smash Remploy because they see it as a bastion of strong trade unions looking after disabled workers. And it's an absolute crying shame. I just wish some people could have come and seen Remploy workers at work, because they really are, it's hard to say, but they really are a credit to the working class. They do, with all the problems, they work as hard and as well as anybody else ever does, and it's a real crying shame that a lot of them are just never going to work again for the next, and some of them will be out of work for 20 years.
And also now, of course, they'll have quite a lot of work to do trying to make sure that they can claim right benefits and not get evicted from their homes, Kevin.
Well, this is the worry. I mean, we know from people who took the redundancy in 2008, thinking they were going to find jobs in 2008, having took redundancy and still and never found jobs when things were a lot better than they are now. And their health has seriously suffered. People have become housebound because they just end up so desperate and run down. A few people have obviously died, and we just don't know how many of those have been hurried along because of the way they've ended up and the fact that they've become so stressed out as a result of what's been done to them. I just hope that, say, Estimate Vey and before her, Maria Miller, factory killer, I just hope they can live with their consciences if they get told about former employee workers passing away and looking like they've gone away sooner than they should have done.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Maria Miller there. I believe she was somebody who was supposed to be a disabled people's campaigner that actually came out with the original report which the government used to justify closing Remploy.
Yeah. Well, she stumbled from one disaster to another, hadn't she? Because she got promoted as a thank you for leading the start of the decimation of Remploy and moved to culture. And look at the mess she made of the BBC. She was in charge of the BBC when all the problems there erupted. So her track record's not brilliant. Estimate Vey, who succeeded her, she actually was speaking against the government's closure programme for Remploy 1 week, gets made a minister for the disabled the next week, and immediately turns around and says, well, I was wrong, you should shut it. So
anyway, with the lessons that you've learnt, Kevin, from this, is there anything you can say to listeners who are angry about this, possibly disabled people listening, really to buoy them up? Because it's a bit depressing, isn't it, when you see a strong, rich, powerful City of London-led government just simply smashing them disabled people under the fist?
Yeah. I mean, all we can say to people is, when you finally get in 2015, which it looks like it's going to be, just remember what this government have done to workers such as Remploy, and use your vote at the ballot box. Equally, we want to work with disabled workers and we want to talk to the Labour Party in the run-up to 2015 and beyond. It's not going to be a quick fix, but we've got to look at how we go back now to promoting better employment for disabled workers within the workplace. I'd love to think we could reinvent the wheel, but I'm a realist. I just think that once Remploy has finally shut the doors, it will be very, very difficult for any government to reinvent it all again. But we've got to do something different that actually finds a way of getting disabled workers into the workplace and in a comfortable environment for them.
Because, of course, one of the other things which we found out talking to the local Remploy workers here in Bristol was that actually the workplace was itself part of their support network, and that's now gone.
Yeah. Well, we know Remploy workers who, and it sounds awful, but they have got no family life, they've got no family, no support. And we knew Remploy workers who went home on a Friday afternoon when they finished work, came back into work on Monday, and would probably never have spoken to anybody other than the odd shopkeeper over the weekend. With Remploy workers who, the fellow workers on Monday morning, would take them into a shower and let them have a shower because they've probably never washed since Friday. Because there is no care in this society anymore. And Remploy was a family to people. People supported each other when they were depressed. There was people there who understood them, knew how they felt, and could help them. A lot of that has gone, and we're really worried about some people and what's going to happen to them. But all we can do is we will carry on fighting as ever. And I mean, the one thing I do know is as I've been a trade union officer for approaching 24 years, full-time officer, and I'm so proud of the Remploy workers and the way they were prepared to stand up and fight. And if there was any justice in the world, they would have won their argument and they would have won their battles. It's just a shame that with this government, it all fell on deaf ears.
Well, I suppose one thing we can take from all this, Kevin, is to just, if we've got disabled neighbours, friends, relatives, just maybe spend an extra few minutes just making sure they're okay, because, you know, this, for, I think, is a hammer blow for many of them, and particularly those Remploy workers, but also there are all sorts of changes to the benefits system, which are really hitting home. So I think, I mean, maybe, I hope you agree that maybe a good thing to do is just to check on your neighbours, check on your friends, relatives.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, people know, I think, now to worry about perhaps a lonely elderly person who may live on their own, and think about your disabled neighbour as well, who's in the same situation. If you know somebody's got a disability that gives them problems, just be a good neighbour, see if they're all right. If you've not seen them for a day or two, go and knock on the door. They'll not think you're being nosy. They'll just be so appreciative that people do care.
Well, Kevin Hepworth, lead officer for Remploy at Unite the Union, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
No, you're welcome, Tom. Thanks very much for all your support.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now on to Syria, Martin, and St. Petersburg. If you were a fly on the wall at St. Petersburg, what would your thoughts be tonight?
Well, I imagine what President Putin is doing is he's getting all of his intelligence intercepts and everything to show the Western powers, and of course the G20, the BRIC countries are there, the Indians and the Brazilians and so on. Basically, the case for war is completely... there is no case for war. Well, it looks increasingly as if it was definitely the rebels that carried out the chemical weapons attack. And maybe we're going to have to start bombing their positions if chemical weapons are so awful and the rebels are using them. Maybe the RAF needs to give Assad's boys a bit of a hand, eh?
One of the things I should have done last week, you can slap my wrist now if you want to, but it was to find out the way that all of our local MPs here voted last week when the mm-hmm. House of Commons was recalled. Actually quite an important vote, wasn't it? Because essentially what they were voting for was potentially, anyway, something which might actually be outside international law to go bypass the United Nations and to attack based on some video footage which had been shown on television. I mean, we can't really run the world like this, can we? Based on, we see something on TV and we react accordingly. But anyway, we've got Chris Skidmore up in Kingswood. He's Conservative MP. He voted for the war on Syria. Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP, she voted against. Dawn Primorolo, Labour, she voted not at all. She didn't take part in the vote. I'm not sure quite whether that's because she's one of the deputy speakers or whether she just didn't make it up to the Commons. Jack Lopresti, Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, up there, he's a Conservative MP. Jack Lopresti, he didn't vote either. I understand he's going through a course of chemotherapy at the moment. Get well soon, Jack. He couldn't make it. Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP, he voted for the war along with Chris Skidmore. He's Lib Dem Bristol West. And Charlotte Leslie, she's a Conservative MP, but she didn't vote. I couldn't actually get any kind of explanation why Charlotte didn't vote, but whether that's an abstention or she just decided she didn't want to take part, I don't know. So there were three votes, one from Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East. She voted against the action in Syria. Chris Skidmore, Conservative, Kingswood, voted for it, as did Stephen Williams, Lib Dem, for Bristol West. Martin.
Yeah, well, I think that's quite an interesting toll, isn't it, when you work out what MPs did it, our MPs did. I'm glad to see that Kerry did the right thing. I mean, the Labour Party as a whole did the right thing, because of course what Cameron presumed was that he would just bamboozle Ed Miliband along, and we'd the bombs were supposed to be falling last week. And I'm glad to say that 30 Conservative MPs, not our local MPs, sadly, but 30 Conservative MPs voted against the war, and I'd like to congratulate them. But I don't want to sound too congratulatory, because people like me congratulating them doesn't do them any favours.
Well, and also there may be subsequent. This may come up again if there are further attacks some sort. Anyway. Let's go to the sort of the main big hitters, as I described them earlier on. In the blue corner, it's John Kerry. So let's hear him setting out his stall to Congress earlier this week.
So we're here because a dictator and his family's enterprise, which is what it is, were willing to infect the air of Damascus with a poison that killed innocent mothers and fathers and children, their lives all snuffed out by gas during the early morning hours of August 21st. The President is asking only for the power to make certain that the United States of America means what we say. He is asking for authorization, targeted and limited, to deter and degrade Bashar al-Assad's capacity to use chemical weapons. If Assad is arrogant enough and foolish enough to retaliate to the consequences of his own criminal activity, the United States and our allies have ample ways to make him regret that decision without going to war. Even Assad's supporters, Russia and Iran, say publicly that the use of chemical weapons is unacceptable. And guess what? Even Iran and Syria itself acknowledge that these weapons were used. They just pretend that the other guys, who don't even have the capacity to do it, somehow did it. This is not the time for armchair isolationism. This is not the time to be spectators to slaughter. This is not the time to give permission to a dictator who has always used these weapons the unfettered ability to continue to use them, because we step back. Neither our country nor our conscience can afford the cost of silence or inaction.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry there setting out his case, Martin, for there to be an intervention in Syria. I also ought to mention he's part of this Skull and Bones Society, isn't it, Yale University, which George W. Bush is too. Mm. I mean, this, first of all, you've got the sort of death's head of the Skull and Bones, part of a secret society, and yet you've got him as supposedly as a Democrat, and you've got George W. Bush as a Republican. How come you've got two opposite political parties, but they're both part of this death's head Skull and Bones Society?
Well, it's interesting, because when Kerry stood against Bush, he threw the election. Basically, Kerry won the election. I think that's fairly clear looking back on it. What happened was that Bush stole the election, and Kerry, because he's a Skull and Bones man, threw in the towel. He shouldn't have thrown in the towel. In Russia or somewhere else, he'd gone back and said, look, Bush is cheating. You've hacked the voting machines. And it was being investigated by Republican, John Conyers and various other people were looking into this.
He has been asked about this Skull and Bones Society. TV is that we can't say anything about it.
Well, the point I'm making about, they're all Skull and Bones, in other words, they're all like the Bullingdon Club or whatever, they're all in it together, and Kerry threw the fight. So Bush got a second term, which he shouldn't have had, because he cheated. He cheated both times, but he cheated the second
time. You're talking about voting fraud, aren't you?
Yeah, and Kerry, because he's a Skull and Bones man, basically threw the fight. And he's got a track record. There's very interesting stuff on the internet of him sitting down to dinner with Bashir Assad when Bashir Assad was flavour of the month. Kerry and his wife sitting down with Bashir and Asma for in a restaurant in Lebanon. There you go. Of course, he's Hitler now, of course.
This has been in the newspapers this week, Martin. I've just got a photocopy of the actual photo here. I mean, you know, this is, which is bizarre, isn't it? It's very much reminiscent of the pictures of Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. I think he was an ambassador, maybe, to Iraq, sitting down and pictures of him sitting down and shaking hands with Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War. The image is believed to have been captured in Damascus in February 2009, come in stark contrast to comments Mr. Kerry made about the Syrian president, describing him as a thug, drawing comparisons between him and Adolf Hitler over his use of chemical weapons, which, of course, hasn't been proven. In fact, as you said, Martin, it certainly has been shown in the past by the United Nations and by the Turkish authorities that the rebels have had chemical weapons. A whole repetitive propaganda, day after day after day, repeating this whole thing of it's the Assad chemical weapons. But I mean, how can you sit down to dinner with somebody and then call them a thug and Adolf Hitler? It just seems that this is American diplomacy gone crazy.
Well, I mean, you know, Bashir Assad will be making a wry smile about this. I mean, he is a dictator, but then so are the people running Saudi Arabia. And what it looks like is that Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, they're the ones who are supplying the rebels with weapons and the Turkish military. And it looks like the Turkish police arrested some Al-Nusra Front people inside Turkey, and they had 2 kilograms of sarin. Where did they get that from? Probably from the Saudis. Now, if it's the Saudis that actually carried out this chemical weapons attack in Damascus that supposedly killed 1,300 people, there's still arguments about how many people died. Of course, 100,000 people have died in the war. If it's the Saudis that carried out that chemical weapons attack, isn't it time that we sent the British fleet to bomb Riyadh? Are we just going to stand by and allow the Saudi ruling class, the Saudi royal family, to kill innocent people, women and children? No, I think it's time for an armed uprising in Saudi Arabia. Let's get the Shia oil workers out on strike and put all of the Saudi ruling class against the wall, just like we did with Gaddafi. We want them executed on YouTube, and they'll cheer.
Well, so why is it, Martin, that the US seems to be so friendly with states like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, which are incredibly oppressive of human rights, almost fascistic dictatorships?
30,000 political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. 30,000.
So why? But why the focus on Syria? Why isn't the West looking at these more dictatorial, fascistic type of countries in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and why are they so focused on
Syria? Well, I mean, let's cut to the chase here. All this stuff about dictators and killing people and so on is just hogwash, really. The real problem is about oil pipelines, and it's about Iran. The Israelis want a general Middle East war, and they see a war in Syria as a way to start a war with Iran. So that's what their project is. The Saudis are also into this game. And of course, what's really going on is that the Syrians and the Iranians are talking about having an oil pipeline which would run through Syria and basically cut out Qatar. Qatar wants to have an oil pipeline that runs through Egypt. So it's all about geopolitical games. And Kerry is just talking basically through his backside about this stuff. As you say, all the evidence so far, and there is evidence that shows that the rebels were using sarin. There's no evidence to show Assad did, and in any case, as Putin pointed out, why would Assad use sarin? His army's winning. Why would he do it?
Okay.
Stupid.
Well, let's go to the other side, to the red side now, the red corner, with Vladimir Putin.
We can't say for sure what happened. We think we should at least wait for the UN inspectors to give their report. We don't have any evidence showing that it was the regular army of the Syrian government that used those chemicals. We don't even know at this point if those were chemical weapons or just some hazardous chemicals. Besides, as I said elsewhere, we think it would be totally absurd for the regular government forces to use banned chemical weapons in a situation where they've encircled the so-called rebels in certain areas and basically are about to finish them off. They're fully aware of the fact that such a step would mean sanctions, including even the use of military force. This is just absurd. It doesn't make any sense. That's the first point. Second, we think that if someone has evidence proving that chemical weapons have been used and that it was the regular army that used them, they should present this evidence to the UN Security Council, to the inspectors and to the Security Council. And this evidence has to be compelling. It should not just be hearsay, just some conversations intercepted by the intelligence service. Even in the US, some experts think the evidence presented by the administration is not compelling. It is possible that the opposition staged a provocation in order to give their patrons an excuse for a military intervention. The videos you're referring to of children who had allegedly been killed in this chemical attack are just horrific. However, the question is, who did it? What exactly was done? And whose fault was it? Those videos don't answer these questions. There's an opinion that this compilation was made by a group of militants who, as both the US administration and we know, are associated with Al-Qaeda. We also know that they have always been notoriously ruthless. Still, I'd like to point out that there are no parents, women, or medical personnel in those pictures, which you would have noticed at a closer look. Who are those people, and what really happened there? This question remains open. Certainly, those pictures are just hideous, but they don't prove anyone guilty. This incident obviously has to be investigated. We would like to know who was responsible for these atrocities. We will not come up with a response unless we get the exact information on who committed these crimes. Speculating and rushing to promise we will do a certain thing would be totally wrong. We don't do that in politics.
Well, they certainly don't in Russia. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts there? Because we've also had the news this week because the UK government let British companies export nerve gas chemicals to Syria. I was quite wondering whether Ed Miliband at Prime Minister's Questions were going to pick this up and throw it at the government, but certainly there was no mention of it there. The UK was accused of breathtaking laxity over an export licence for potassium fluoride and sodium fluoride. This is in The Independent on Monday this week. The government accused of breathtaking laxity, capable of being used to make the nerve gas sarin. But these licences were granted a year ago. Almost unbelievable.
Well, yes, and also because we're also all accepting that if chemical weapons were used, then that's an excuse for an intervention, which of course it isn't. 100,000 people have died in this civil war already, and Roland Dumas, who was the former French foreign minister, has been on the television in France last week saying that before the Arab Spring, before any protests in Syria, he was approached by British officials at a meeting and said, "We are going to organise an armed rebellion in Syria. Are you up for it?" Now, I'd put this question to David Cameron if he was listening. Is Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, a liar? Or was it the case that British MI6, presumably, and special forces organised this armed rebellion in Syria? Because if it was the British who organised the armed rebellion in Syria, as sure as Bashar Assad is responsible, so are we. And if we find that MI6 were responsible, and eventually we are going to find out if they were responsible for organising this uprising, what do you think we should do with those people? People who organise uprisings for 100,000 people.
We'll leave that as an open question, Martin. Anyway, as I promised, we're going to have a listen now to a former US veteran. A US veteran. Former US Marine Ken O'Keefe, to hear what his thoughts are on US interventions around the world. Because one does wonder whether soldiers really themselves are actually up for some of these battles. They seem to be getting more and more tenuous. So here is Ken O'Keefe, former US Marine.
This Republican Democrat thing, all the world is a stage. Obama is a puppet. He reads the script, he's a teleprompter reader, that's his official job. He doesn't make any decisions.
Strings.
The powers that be that have the majority of power in this world are those that control the financial system. The financial crisis, engineered by these same criminals who are the ultimate fraudsters of the world. The Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, those are the real string pullers, that's real power. Those who are destroying this world by fraud and deception is what's out of control. 9/11 was the false flag operation used to justify the invasion of Afghanistan. It is the ultimate deception, and it's done for a full-spectrum dominance agenda, which is part of controlling this world by deception. And unless we as people stand up to these treasonous traitors and all of those people carrying out this stuff and the colluders, including the mass media and the politicians, we are going to continue to get this kind of deception.
Well, that's Ken O'Keefe there, former US Marine, pretty unequivocal, Martin. He's saying that the whole thing is a deception. I mean, is that actually what's going on with this business with the chemical weapons in Syria?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, my reading of the situation now is that the Saudis and their al-Nusra front did this as a way of trying to get the West to get involved.
But he's also talking there about 9/11,
yes,
isn't he? He's saying 9/11.
He is indeed.
And
now,
we've got the anniversary coming up next week.
We have got the anniversary coming up. Now, General Ivashov, Leonid Ivashov, was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11. And if you look at his blog, or anybody looks him up, Ivashov, you will see that he's very calmly, very clearly, he's a retired head of the Russian armed forces, saying, as far as we're concerned, that was a Mossad CIA operation. Now, if we go to war with Russia, what the Russians are going to do they've presumably got telephone intercepts, they've probably got all the information they need about 9/11, and the first thing that's going to happen as the shots are fired is they're going to dump all that onto the internet to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the US armed forces were responsible for 9/11. And of course we've got senior US military officers who are saying the same thing, General Stubblebine and Dr. Alan Sabrowski, Colonel Alan Sabrowski, who used to run the US Army War College. So this is the real world. The real world of World War III is going to be a psychological warfare battle, so the Russians are just going to drop all that onto the internet so everybody knows what's going on. Also, of course, they've got all these anti-ship missiles, which they've been developing for 30 years.
Well, they've been testing one, didn't they, this week, which was a bit naughty, wasn't it?
No, it was the Israelis who were testing. So,
what does that tell us about who's really in charge here? The Israelis, I mean...
Well, the Israelis are just trying to jump the gun.
Yeah, it seemed to me the Americans then ran along on Tuesday and said, oh, yes, this was a joint exercise with us.
No, it wasn't.
To begin with, they didn't know what was going on at all.
What the Israelis were probably trying to do there was provoke the Syrians to do something silly, so that the Americans...
To sink a ship or something?
Yeah. The USS Liberty was nearly sunk in 1967 by the Israeli Air Force, which was an American ship, and the idea was that the Americans would think it was the Egyptians who'd done it, and therefore would attack Egypt. But of course, it was in fact the Israelis who did it, and they admit that they did it now. They said it was a mistake, an accident. So they sank an American ship in order to try and provoke war. That's the sort of thing that the Israelis do. Now, World War III is going to be a lot harder than people like John Kerry imagine. That's why Vladimir Putin does not want World War III. He's trying to avoid World War III. But if idiots like Kerry think they are going to win World War III, they are deluding themselves. They will lose.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, the BBC aired a documentary about respectable European business leaders helping Nazi war criminals to escape in the late 1940s, set up a Fourth Reich financial empire. Well, you may have missed that one. It aired on BBC Radio 4 as part of their document series in 2008, and the reporter was Mike Thompson.
A witness has come forward with information that, if true, would confirm that not only did KLM knowingly fly senior Nazis to Argentina, the airline did so with the active encouragement of the man at the top. Our witness didn't want us to broadcast his name, but he claims that whilst working for KLM as a clerk in 1949 at the age of 17, he overheard a conversation between the boss of KLM, Albert Plesman, and a senior pilot, Adrian Verulli.
I was in the archives, and below me was the room of the boss of the flight department. And in this room, there was a big row taking place between Plesman and Verulli. Got very heated. And Verulli said he'd been given orders to transport black monks to Argentina.
How can you be sure that Mr. Verulli was referring to war criminals or Nazis when he said black monks?
Well, because in the same conversation he said war criminals. And Verulli, as far as I understood, wanted to go public with this. And Plesman replied, if you dare ruin my KLM, I will take steps. After this, a person left the room, I'm not sure whether it was Plesman or Verulli, slamming the door behind him.
When you heard Mr. Plesman saying he was going to take steps against Mr. Verulli, how threatening was his tone of voice?
Well,
he was no longer speaking in a normal tone of voice. He was screaming in anger.
Why have you decided to talk about this now?
I think it's very important that the truth comes out about the involvement of KLM with these criminals.
Fascinating stuff. It's the boss of KLM, Royal Dutch Airlines there, Martin, being involved in these black monks, they call them, Nazi war criminals, over into Argentina. And the guy who overheard the conversation got sacked very soon afterwards. This is Albert Plesman, who was the boss of KLM at the time. And, of course, we know a very senior person at KLM, Royal Dutch Airlines, was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, the former SS officer, too. So we're starting to get a picture emerging. This is even on BBC Radio 4 back in 2008. I don't think they've repeated that documentary. Of quite a lot of collusion at the highest business levels in Europe with Nazi war criminals.
Yeah, well, at the end of the war, the end game of the war is now becoming, the end game of World War II is now becoming increasingly clear. I mean, Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, talks about how Bormann was spirited off to Argentina to organise, you know, to basically being helped by the OSS, which became the CIA. And, of course, people like Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, he was sent to Bolivia by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. So, and the Gladio structures that were put in place in Western Europe at the end of World War II, a lot of ex-Nazis were recruited to that. And of course, there's a book, the Operation GB. I've forgotten the name. Creighton, isn't it? Who's written that book?
OPJB, standing for Operation James Bond, by Christopher Creighton. You're talking about. But don't jump the gun.
Yeah.
We're going to have another clip from that, and we'll talk about that fascinating book, which you, I understand, have read recently. After this second clip, where we hear Dr. Norm Goder talking about this too.
One of the concerns, particularly in 1947 and 1948, was that Nazis could slip through the net. SS officers particularly could slip through the net. There were certain notorious figures who, as of 1947 and 1948, had not been caught. The great Nazi ghost who is out there is certainly Bormann.
Martin Bormann is alive.
Do you know where Bormann is? Do you know what he's doing?
No.
A major, major figure within the Nazi hierarchy who, in essence, controlled most access to Hitler himself.
It seems it wasn't only the concern that such men were escaping punishment for their past crimes, but the fear that, once safely settled in South America, they might threaten world peace all over again.
The United States government was very concerned about the possibility of a Fourth Reich. That German officials or Nazi sympathizers could find their way to South America and act in various subversive ways.
Well, that was Dr. Norm Goder there, and the programme was a BBC documentary called Document on BBC Radio 4 back in 2008, produced and presented by Mike Thompson. Martin, tell us about this book, OPJB, then.
Well, it's written by Creighton, I believe, that's the name of the chap. He was actually a British agent in the Navy, and he was parachuted into Berlin at the end of the war. They took Bormann out. They got him out by took him out in kayaks, and then he was taken to Britain, and then the British then took Bormann to America. Now, when they're talking about people slipping through the net and so on, I think an executive decision was made at the top of the establishment in Britain and the US that certain people were going to be punished, others were just going to be basically incorporated into their structure. So Reinhard Gehlen, for example, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, ends up running the BND, the German West German.
This particular operation to get Martin Bormann out, though, is described in this book absolutely fascinating. Mm. And the person in charge of it was this guy Desmond Morton, who was the personal assistant to Winston Churchill. Mm. Very sort of spooky figure, friendly with Aleister Crowley. And Morton, it seems, and Churchill were involved in the decision. And this was a completely secret organisation, part of MI6. I think the fascinating thing
was outside MI6.
Well, okay, so it was called M Section. Yeah. The fascinating thing here is, of course, that a lot of this stuff has been written about only fairly recently because, of course, it was all covered by Official Secrets. This week, we hear the Nuremberg Rallies site is going to be repaired. £60 million is going to be spent on renovating the city's vast yet dilapidated Nazi Party rally grounds.
Well, I mean, maybe it's a useful piece of kit. Maybe we should keep it. But, I mean, the real problem with places like Auschwitz, because they're falling down now. They're only temporary camps. And what do? Do you let it fall down or do you fix it?
Well, I think maybe you just build on it. But anyway, time to sign off now. Coming up next, Cyrus the Virus, a typical topical Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Syria Doble. Also, thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's page and our archives. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, deep divisions still remain between the US and Russia over the next steps in Syria. Presidents Obama and Putin had a private meeting at the G20 summit of world leaders. Russia insists most of the countries that have taken part in St. Petersburg over the last few days are against military action. But Barack Obama says he's been encouraged by discussions he's had.
There is a growing recognition that the world cannot stand idly by. Here in St. Petersburg, leaders from Europe, Asia, and the Middle East have come together to say that the international norm against the use of chemical weapons must be upheld.
The Unite Union has been cleared of trying to fix the selection process for a parliamentary candidate in Falkirk. Despite doing nothing wrong, Carrie Murphy, who was backed by Unite, has withdrawn from the race for the seat. There are long delays on the M25 because of a security alert at the Dartford crossing, which has closed the bridge and tunnel. Officers have arrested a man and say they've found a suspicious item. Coronation Street actor Michael Avell has told a jury that dark secrets in his life were a string of one-night stands and not the rape of a young girl. The soap star denies 12 charges. Food safety officials are ordering the recall of any lamb, beef and mutton processed by a firm in Aberystwyth. The company, called Farmbox Meats, is no longer trading but is suspected of not handling meat at the proper temperature. England kick off their latest World Cup qualifier against Moldova in an hour's time at Wembley Stadium. Meanwhile, the Republic of Ireland are looking to go second in Group C. They must beat Sweden as well as Austria, losing to leaders Germany for that to happen. Assistant manager Marco Tardelli thinks a win and a draw from the next two games is a minimum requirement.
Yes.